Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows in for Craig Cohen. If you were listening before the newscast, you heard me list four terrible things that happened in Chicago during a two-week period in the summer of 1919. Before reading the new book, City of Scoundrels, I had heard of one of them, the Chicago race riots of that year, but not the others. Let's say hello now to the author of City of Scoundrels, Gary Crist. Welcome to Focus.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And where have we reached you? Out in Maryland, I thought you were living?
Yeah, I'm in Bethesda, Maryland, which is just north of Washington, D.C.
Okay, so Chicago is not your usual stomping grounds.
No. I'm a historian, very interested in cities, but I don't follow Chicago politics today or anything like that. But I'm very, very interested in big cities, which is what drew me to this story.
Well, Gary, I know there have been books written about the 1919 Chicago race riots alone. How did you become aware of this cluster of events in the summer of 1919, and why did you choose to treat all of them together in your book?
Well, I had been aware of the Chicago race riot. There had been a very good book written about it in the 70s, I think, and I was thinking that maybe it was time to re-examine this, and I was just reading newspaper microfilm and finding out that all of this other stuff was going on at the same time. This is one reason why it's good for historians to actually read microfilm rather than just run database searches, because if I had just been looking for things about the riot, I just would have gotten articles about the riot, and I wouldn't realize that there was this major transit strike, there was this very sensationalistic child murder, and a blimp crash that all happened in the space of 12 days. So, if you were living in Chicago at this time, you would be exposed to all of those things. And it's an important lesson, I think, for historians to remember that, it's always something. Things don't happen in isolation.
Well, listeners, as we continue our discussion, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is willpublicmedia. Gary Crist, I wanted to ask first about the first bad thing that happens in City of Scoundrels, and that's the crash of the Goodyear Wingfoot Express into the Illinois Trust and Savings Bank building, killing 13 people. Now, I understand from your book that this was really the first big aviation accident in the country. Was it really something people had not expected could happen?
Yeah, there had been, isolated cases of airplanes going down with a pilot aboard. But blimps were very much a new phenomenon at this time. They had been used very successfully in World War I, and now they were exploring the possibilities of using them as commercial means of transport. And, in fact, that was what was going to happen with this Wingfoot Express. It was an old Army model that they were going to try to sell to somebody for a commercial airline service. And as a matter of fact, that morning, that very morning that the blimp went up, there had been an article in the Chicago Daily News about how Chicago was going to become the blimpopolis of the world. And forget about New York and all those coastal cities. They were just going to be stopovers, but blimps were going to go from Chicago to London to Paris and all these things. And so they were very interested in getting publicity for this new technology. And that was one of the reasons why they were flying the blimp over the city. It had taken a couple of test flights early in the morning, and then it was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a Monday afternoon, and they took a newspaper photographer up who was going to take pictures from the blimp, and they had instructions from corporate headquarters in Akron that, make sure a lot of people see this blimp, because we really want to make a push for this. And so they were flying over the loop. This was before anybody even thought of having legislation to prevent aviation over a major urban area. And so it was taking a test flight, and they don't know why it happened, but it caught fire and lost buoyancy, and it crashed right into the skylight of the Illinois Trust and Savings Bank, which is was right across from the Board of Trade building. And the bank was closed at the time, but there were still hundreds of employees inside, particularly in this courtyard area. And the fuel tanks exploded. It became a horrifying inferno and ended up killing about 13 people and injuring dozens more. But the shock was worse than anything because no one had really conceived of this as a danger before this because it was such a new technology. But so it sent sort of a wave of hysteria through the city about, you know, what could be more safe than a downtown bank? You're in the middle of a downtown bank and suddenly this flaming blimp comes through the skylight. So it was an eye-opening experience for the whole city.
That's the first bad thing. The second bad thing was the race riot. And I was struck in reading the account of the 1919 race riot. Late 20th century race riots in the U.S. Are usually summarized, as far as I know, as residents of poor black neighborhoods rioting in a trigger response to a particular perceived injustice, say like the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which was right. Followed by rioting in Chicago, among other cities. Mm-hmm. But the 1919 Chicago race riots were different than that.
Well, they were often in a post-war period, there are a lot of social and economic tensions that are going on, and that was the case here. During the war, the local economy in Chicago was booming. You know, factories were churning out things to support the war effort. And since a lot of the young men were in Europe fighting, there was a real labor shortage. So there was an active recruitment effort, particularly in the American South, to bring African-American workers up to fill that wartime labor shortage. This was the beginning of the Great Migration of African-Americans from the South. So, you know, while the war is going on and while the economy is humming, things are working all right, wages are high, things are working, but then the war ends, and suddenly the factories are pulling back from their peak production, and so they have to lay people off. Meanwhile, the soldiers are coming back, and they're looking for jobs, and during the war, basically residential construction in the city had come to a halt. So what you have in the post-war situation is more people chasing fewer jobs and a stagnant number of housing units. So these tensions were building up over the course of the entire year, 1919, and there had been sporadic violence in the parks. There had been bombing campaigns. Since all of these new African Americans had moved into the city, they were moving into neighborhoods that were previously all white, and so there would be bombings in buildings where a black family had just moved in. So this was building up, and then these various tensions kind of exploded all at once. I think because the city was traumatized from the blimp crash and the child murder that we were talking about, there was an incident on a Southside beach that it started out as a fight. A small boy was drowned because a white guy was throwing rocks at him he was on a raft in the lake, and things just spiraled out of control, and all the tensions that had been building up over the course of the year were explosively let out. And for days and days, people were just killing each other on the streets, and it was a horrible experience. It was just chaos in Chicago for several days.
Was that mostly on the South Side, or was that on the North Side as well?
Well, it started on the South Side, and most of the rioting did take place on the South Side in and around what they called the Black Belt at the time. But toward the third and fourth day of the riot, it started spreading to the North Side, to the West Side, and eventually came into the Loop. Eventually they put policemen all around the so-called Black Belt, and so these roving white gangs said, all right, if we can't go there, we're just going to go into the Loop. And so they marched into the Loop on the fourth day of the riot and were basically taking black workers from local hotels and restaurants and horribly beating them. And this was, you know, once it got into the Loop, I think the local business community, that's when the local business community says, my God, this is getting out of control. And, of course, when the local business community wants to take action, they get action. And eventually, the militia was called in, the National Guard, and they restored order.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, filling in for Craig Cohen. My guest is author Gary Crist. He's the author of several books of fiction, but we're talking today about the events covered in his second book of nonfiction, City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago, published by Crown Publishers. And we welcome your questions and comments about this piece of Chicago history at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we've only gotten through two of the four bad things that happened that summer. A little girl was disappeared. I mean, that's initially all that was known, is that she was gone.
Right. She was coming home from a park where she had been playing with her friends, and they were dallying along the street, window shopping, and finally they said, okay, goodbye. And she parted from her friends, and then she totally disappeared, and nobody knew what had happened to her. And for days, the whole city was totally consumed with this notion. She was apparently the pet of the neighborhood, very popular in the neighborhood. And so this was getting, believe it or not, bigger headlines than either the blimp crash or the race riot. People wanted to find out what had happened to Janet Wilkinson. And suspicion fell early on their next-door neighbor, who was this guy who had shown what they called a, quote, conspicuous interest in young children, unquote. And they were sweating him in the basement of the police department for hours on end. They did not let him sleep for days. They were trying all kinds of bizarre ways of making him talk because they were pretty certain that he had something to do with her disappearance. And so they sent in a cop dressed as a priest. They set him in front of a table that had doll parts on it. I don't know quite what that was supposed to do. But eventually they would slap him whenever he tried to sleep. And, you know, all of this police work would be totally illegal today. But in those days, there weren't such stringent rules. Finally, after about 4 or 5 days of sweating this guy, he confessed. And he had seen the girl coming up the stairs to her apartment, and he invited her in, offering candy. And she did come in, and he grabbed her, and she started screaming, and he ended up strangling her and burying her in the coal bin in the basement. But this set, when it was found out what had happened, this sent another wave of hysteria through the city about whether our own next-door neighbors can be trusted with our children. So there was this sense in the city, I think, at the time, that there were all of these new urban dangers that people had been vaguely aware of, but they never really considered them a threat to their own family. And now you have a blimp crashing in the downtown bank. You have, you know, a child being murdered by the pervert next door. So there was this real sense of new dangers, new half-understood dangers. And I think all of that kind of played into the reaction. It played into the violence that erupted, because the very same day that the guy confessed was the day that the race riot happened. The race riot began.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, in for Craig Cohen. My guest is Gary Crist, author of City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago. We welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And before I get to the fourth bad thing that happened during these, it's really just 12 days, but there's a major character we really ought to be talking about, and I guess he would be one of the scoundrels in the title of your book, and that's the mayor of Chicago, William Hale Thompson.
Right. Yeah, I have to say that Thompson was God's gift to any narrative historian. He was this extremely colorful, extravagantly corrupt machine politician who fancied himself a cowboy and always wore a big cowboy hat. And he liked to think of himself as the people's David, defending the common Chicagoan against the Goliaths of wealth and privilege. And he was also a big champion of the Chicago Plan, which was a Daniel Burnham's plan that was going to remake Chicago and turn it into the Paris of the Prairie. And, of course, it involved a lot of construction projects, which he liked, Big Bill liked, because it allowed for plenty of kickbacks and patronage. So he called himself Big Bill the Builder. But unfortunately, at the time of this crisis, he was involved in a very personal battle with the governor of Illinois, Frank Loudon. As you know, sometimes in Illinois politics, the mayor of Chicago and the governor of Illinois don't always get along. And they were actually former friends. They were both Republicans, former friends. But once Loudon had gotten into office, with the help of Thompson's political machine, he had decided that he was done with machine politics and didn't want to play that game anymore, so naturally this made him an enemy in Thompson's eyes. So you had the city in crisis, and people at this point were calling on both the mayor and the governor to send in the National Guard, declare martial law, do anything to restore order. But Big Bill didn't want to do that because he didn't want to be seen as going to his arch enemy, the governor, for help. He would have to make a formal request of the governor for the militia. So he kept on saying, no, no, the police have the situation under control, which was nonsense. And meanwhile, Governor Loudon didn't want to do anything. He was running for president in 1920, and he was afraid that if he made some unilateral decision against the mayor's wishes, that that could prove controversial and harm his ability to get the nomination. So he kept on saying, I can't call in the militia without the mayor's written request. So basically you had these two political enemies staring each other down over a table, a conference table, while the city was burning to the ground all around them practically.
And that brings us now to the fourth bad thing during this 12-day period, and that was the transit strike.
Yeah, this was 2 days into the race riot. There had been talk for a long time of a transit strike. The summer of 1919, Chicago saw more strikes, lockouts, basically labor strife than at any point in its history before then. This was, as I was saying about the post-war tensions and the dislocations that happen when a war ends. And finally, the transit workers just said, we're walking out. This was 2 days into the strike, so every streetcar and L train in the city ground to a halt right at the height of the violence. So all of these people had to basically find their way to work through streets where people were shooting at each other and throwing rocks at each other. So it was the final straw, basically. The city was in total chaos at this point because nobody could get anywhere. The violence was escalating, and if Thompson hadn't given in and called in the militia, I don't know what would have happened to the city.
And so we have these four bad things, and what do you think that what did people think about when you look at the accounts look at what people read afterwards? What did they think was happening to Chicago at this time? What did the nation think?
At this point, cities were still relatively independent of each other. There were articles about this in every newspaper in the country, but we weren't quite as tightly knit a nation as we were then. But certainly in Chicago, I mean. One of my most fortunate discoveries was this diary by a girl named Emily Frankenstein, who kept a diary of everything that was happening in 1919. And she was a very ebullient and intellectually curious 17-year-old girl from this wealthy doctor's family in Kenwood. And she was keeping a diary, and most of it was about her budding romance with Jerry Lapiner, this soldier that her parents didn't approve of. But every once in a while, she would pull away and sort of talk about a blimp crashed in downtown, and everybody is so upset by it. Nobody knows what's going on. And then when the race riot happened, she was telling about how her father was returning from making a house call, and he almost got caught in the crossfire of rioters. And so I really wanted to use this girl as sort of the character that would tell me what was the average Chicagoan thinking at this point. And basically what they were thinking is the city is falling apart. She, as a matter of fact, she even said something like that. Will the city ever get back to normal? I think people were panicking and just thinking that civic order had just totally disintegrated and they didn't know what was going to happen next.
That was making me wonder about, you know, the research you did for this. And, of course, you've mentioned all the newspapers you've gone through. They're well cited in the book. But how do you find a document like Emily Frankenstein's diary?
Well, that was it's in the collection of the Chicago History Museum Research Center. And several of the staff there, I'm eternally grateful to them for alerting me to this. They also alerted me to a typewritten memoir that was written by one of the scions of the Morton Salt family, who was one of the militiamen at the time. So he wrote a memoir that was never published, but it's in the collection of the Chicago History Museum, telling exactly what he did on the nights of the riot. So I'm, as a narrative historian, I'm really interested in these kinds of documents because I'm always interested in telling the story in a way that the reader can experience what was going on him or herself. So if I can find a memoir that talks about a scene, that quotes dialogue, I'm always in the market for that because I always want to be able to bring the history alive through actual scenes as you would have them in a novel. But since, you know, I'm a historian now, not a novelist. I don't make it up. I can't make it up. So I really have to seek out these documents. And fortunately, they do exist. I would have loved to have a few more diaries and memoirs, but I made the best I could with what was available.
And that raises a point I was wondering about the newspaper accounts. And how many newspapers did Chicago have in 1919?
There were six major dailies. Two of them were Hearst-owned. And there were a number of black weeklies. There were a couple of Polish dailies, which I could make use of because they exist in translation in a database that I could access. So this was a time when, you know, even a small city had a couple of newspapers. Now we're lucky if a city has one. But this was before television and the internet, so newspapers were how people got their news. Of course, that made the job very difficult for me because I wanted to read every page of every newspaper for at least that 12-day period. So I spent a lot of time in the Harold Washington Library reading newspaper microfilm.
Well, this also raises the question, when you look at all of these accounts together, along with any other historical documents you were able to find, did you find the day-by-day newspaper coverage to be largely accurate?
I did. You had to make judgments based on the politics of the particular paper. Most of the papers were staunchly against the mayor. They hated the mayor. The two Hearst newspapers were somewhat more sympathetic to him, but they regarded him as a demagogue who was against basically the people who owned papers in those days were, you know, rich, wealthy capitalists. And so you had to, anytime they were reporting on the mayor, you had to take it with a grain of salt. There was this one scene where there's a parade and for the returning soldiers, and they like to depict Big Bill as anti-soldier because he was a pacifist during the war. And so one reporter allegedly quoted a little kid who said, "Oh, look, the mayor's here. I thought he didn't like soldiers," or something like that. That I included that in the book, but with the disclaimer, I said the boy was probably fictionalized. You know, he was probably made up by the reporter, but what it shows is what at least the Chicago Tribune was thinking about the mayor at that point.
We're talking to Gary Crist, the author of City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago, and we're taking your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at willtalk@illinois.edu. We'll be continuing this conversation after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Craig Cohen will be back tomorrow, and we're talking with author Gary Crist. In his new book, City of Scoundrels, he looks back at a cluster of terrible events that happened in Chicago in the latter part of July 1919. It's quite a story in itself, but it also serves as the beginning of the city of Chicago we know today. And that brings up another question I had. You've already mentioned the Chicago Plan, which Mayor Thompson was advocating at that point. And I was wondering, some of this stuff got built despite all the terrible things that were going on in those 12 days in 1919. If you walk around Chicago today, will you see evidence of the Chicago Plan?
Oh, definitely. Although, you know, some of it is adapted from Burnham's original plan, and a lot of it wasn't built, but a lot of the park system, the waterfront parks, a lot of the boulevards, the whole Michigan Avenue Bridge, which, when it opened, made possible the development of Northern Michigan Avenue, which, of course, became the Magnificent Mile. Navy Pier was part of it. There were actually supposed to be two piers originally. They only got one of them built. But I do think one of the virtues of Big Bill Thompson, you know, he was terribly corrupt. He was a buffoon in many respects. But he did get things built. And as one contemporary newspaperman said, you know, Thompsonism may be corrupt, but it does build avenues and bridges, even if they end up costing a lot more than they should. And they did end up costing a lot more than they should, but they did get done because he fancied himself Big Bill the Builder. And so I think that's one of the legacies that he left behind that is sometimes ignored. You know, he was considered by a panel of historians as the worst mayor in American history of any American city. And I don't think that I would disagree necessarily, but I do think that some of his virtues are given short shrift. Another thing that I think he did that should be remembered is he was one of the first major urban mayors who realized that African Americans were a vital part of the electorate, and he really brought African Americans into the political process in a way, you know, alleged progressives at the time were not doing this kind of thing. And so he doubled the number of African Americans on the police force. He named a lot of blacks to high positions in his administration. As a matter of fact, the local press called City Hall Uncle Tom's Cabin at some point because he was bringing so many African Americans into the process. So you know, he was a buffoon. He was horribly corrupt, one of the most corrupt mayors in history. But he was not without his virtues.
And he was also a Republican. He's the last Republican mayor Chicago has had to date. I'm wondering about that. In the Chicago political scene today, Republicans are virtually not there. Is there a connection between Thompson's reputation and the fortunes of the Republican Party in Chicago in the century since?
Well, I think that the parties have changed significantly since 1919. This was a point when African Americans were almost universally voting Republican. This was, you know, Republicans were still considered the party of Lincoln. This was really before, I think it was in FDR's period that the big switch when African Americans stopped voting Republican and started voting Democrat. And there was a left and a white a left and a right wing to both parties, which we don't have today. I mean, today, basically, the Democrats are the Liberal Party and the Republicans are the Conservative Party, whereas in an earlier era, there were left and right wings to each party. So it was a different situation. And I think now, at least in Chicago, it's going to be a long time, I think, before Republicans can make a mark again. The Republican machine that existed in Thompson's day was nothing like the later Democratic machine, which was more or less all powerful. Thompson's organization was one of only was one of several in each party, and so he was able to maintain power for about 12 or 13 years, mainly through building coalitions. He didn't have that total control that the two dailies had. I'm no expert on Chicago politics today, but I do know that there's still an organization there that has a pretty firm grip on power, and so I think it'll be a long time before Republicans will make their mark again in Chicago. But people are always surprised to learn that there was once this Republican machine in Chicago.
And also should note, to get the right historical context, is that Mayor Thompson served a non-consecutive third term in the 20s that I think brought him up into the beginning of the Depression.
Right. Yeah. He had, after his second term, some very close advisors were involved in this horrible corruption scheme, and he said, "My friends have crucified me," because he maintained that he was not corrupt, but the people around him were. And so he didn't even run in 1923. And in 1923, a very well-meaning progressive Democrat became mayor, and he enforced, although he didn't care about prohibition. At this point, prohibition had come in 1920. He didn't support it himself personally, but he thought, "I'm mayor of this Chicago, and the law is that people cannot drink alcohol." So he enforced prohibition to the letter, and this created such tension among the beer barons that violence on the streets of Chicago reached new levels of extremity. And so after one term, he was voted out, and they voted Thompson back in. They'd rather have the crook in office. But unfortunately, by his third term, Thompson had a nervous breakdown. All of his smart political advisors had sort of gone away at this point. So his third term was pretty much a disaster. That's when you had Chicago becoming the lawless city of legend, the jazz age lawless city with the Al Capone basically having his way with the whole city. And Thompson was barely present, particularly he had this nervous breakdown which kept him out of the office for months at a time. And so the city was kind of rudderless for a good part of his third term. And he did run again in 1931, but he lost to Anton Cermak, who that was sort of the beginning of Democratic dominance of Chicago politics.
Okay, we're talking to Gary Crist, author of City of Scoundrels on Focus. And we have, the caller has not stayed with us, but we do have the question from Candace in Urbana. And just a quick check here. Is the late Mayor Thompson any relation to the former Governor Jim Thompson of the modern era and also a Republican?
There was no relation between them. As a matter of fact, people were confused when I was first researching. They were saying, "Wait, he was a governor, not a mayor, right?" And I said, "No, not that Thompson." So it's a fairly common name. So the confusion is understandable.
I want to go back to one of the events in City of Scandals, and that's the abduction and murder of little Janet Wilkinson. And your book talks about efforts following that crime to crack down on morons, which has a specific definition in this case, different from just calling someone a very stupid person. And who were authorities targeting when they talked about blaming child abductions on morons and mental defectives?
Well, it was sort of the word, the unfortunate term used at the time for child predators. And they believed at the time, psychology was in a very early stage of its development. They believed that there was sort of a connection between low intelligence and this kind of perverted behavior, if you want to call it that. And there was such trauma created in the city because of this Janet Wilkinson case. It brought to the fore a problem that I think most urbanites in 1919 knew about but never really conceived of as a threat to their own families. child predators were seen as something kind of alien and distant, not something you would expect in your own neighborhood. Of course, this type of thing was happening in your own neighborhood, but most cases were never reported because parents were reluctant to expose their children to the horrors of the publicity that would be involved. But since the Janet Wilkinson case was so sensational, it forced people to face this for the first time, and people were coming out of the woodwork saying, my child was also bothered by, a middle-aged man. And there was this sense that there was this epidemic going on in the city that nobody had talked about before. And so they really went into panic mode, and there was talk of taking anyone who might even be remotely possible of this kind of behavior and, like, shipping them off to farms in the countryside. And, it would have been something totally unconstitutional today. I mean, you can't jail people for things they haven't done but that they might do in the future. But there was, the city was in a panic. They thought that they had a real epidemic here of child predators, and so they were demanding of the public officials to do something and proactively put these people away.
And did they have anything like an accurate bead on who potential child predators were, or were they sending away people who were just, there's really no possibility that they would be a threat?
Well, they thought they had. They thought they had this diagnosis of dementia praecox, and they thought they knew they could predict who would behave in this way. But I think it was really unscientific. And although I don't think those efforts to isolate people got very far, I would imagine that a lot of innocent people were caught up in the hysteria.
Now, I'm looking at another one of the disasters of this period, and that's the airship disaster. And, in the long term, airships have not become a major part of aviation. But did the crash of the Wingfoot Express have an impact on future efforts to make aviation safer?
Oh, definitely. There was a coroner's inquest afterwards that unfortunately had to end early because of the race riot, and the coroner became very busy with the race riot, and so the inquiry ultimately found that we cannot hold anybody responsible for this blimp crash because there is no law governing aviation over an urban area. And so what happened at both the local level and the national level, Congress went into session on this, and they devised regulations for governing where you could operate an airship. And over the Loop of Chicago was not one of those places. So there was a big push toward regulating this new thing that hadn't been regulated before. But there were also changes in design. This was the time when helium was too expensive to use in airships, so they used hydrogen, which is much more flammable. And as a result of the Wingfoot Express crash, in America at least, they stopped using hydrogen, and even though it was more expensive, they started using helium. This was not true in other countries, which is why when you had the Hindenburg, that was a German airship, and that was, and that exploded very dramatically in the 1930s, but at that point, American airships were using helium.
Now, I was trying to figure out exactly what happened with the Wingfoot Express. I thought I was reading at one point in the book that the investigation found that what was burning was not the hydrogen, but the materials of the airship itself.
Right.
Did the helium ignite in this accident, or do they know?
They don't know. They had to abandon it. They had all kinds of experts at the inquest giving them all kinds of stories about sparking and friction, and one expert even said that there was a radio tower in one of the buildings and the radio waves somehow set the thing on fire. Essentially, the inquest ended and they didn't know what caused it, and they still to this day are not sure what caused it. But, they did decide that it wasn't the hydrogen that was igniting. It was the balloon. So it didn't explode in the sky. It just burned away, and all the hydrogen, escaped. And so the ship lost buoyancy and it fell to Earth. Once it hit the bank building, the fuel tanks exploded, and that's why there was such an inferno in the courtyard of the Illinois Trust and Savings Bank. It was the fuel, not the gas in the balloon, that ignited.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, in for Craig Cohen. There's still time for your questions and comments. For author Gary Crist, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm sorry I left the dash out the last time I gave our email address, but it is will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, or toll free at 800-222-WILL. The race riot. How did the race riot finally come to an end?
There had been this standoff between the mayor and the governor over who was going to give in first and ask for the militia. Finally, Thompson allegedly got word of a citywide arson plot. Both blacks and whites were going to set fire to each other's neighborhoods, and the whole city was going to go up in flames, reminiscent of 1871. So finally, I think Thompson said, I've got to give in. And so he gave in, he sat down, and wrote out the official written request to the governor for the militia. And fortunately, at the same time the militia came in, they had been in the city for days, but they were sitting in armories all around the city and just getting stir-crazy. They wanted to go out in the street and engage with the rioters, but they couldn't until they had the official word that they were going to be deployed. So they came out on the fourth day of the riot, about midnight, went through the streets. They set up howitzers on street corners. They had their rifles and bayonets, and there were some scenes reminiscent of World War I on the streets of Chicago as they engaged with some of these roaming white gangs in particular. But finally, about 24 hours it took them, they had more or less restored order. It was helped by a very well-timed rainstorm that came and sort of broke the heat, which is always a factor in urban riots, and they always happen in summer. It's always when it's really hot. So the weather broke, the militia got into the streets, and order was eventually returned. You know, there were sporadic skirmishes going on for days after what I would call the end of the riot. And there was a big fire that had been set in the back of the yards neighborhood that happened a couple days after the militia went in. But more or less, they had restored order.
We have one question that's been called in, and that was there any connection with the killing of little Janet Wilkinson and the riots? For instance, was the killer of the child African-American? Was there any connection like that?
No. The killer was a guy named Thomas Fitzgerald. He was, I guess an Irishman living next door. But I do think that the rawness of the feeling after the blimp crash and the whole Janet Wilkinson debacle, I think, did play into some of the arrogance you saw on the street, some of the aggression you saw on the street. I think Chicago at that point was just a raw nerve, and it just took something to set it in motion. And so I think there was no direct link between the child abduction and murder and the race riot.
How was the transit strike resolved?
It turned out that, they thought that they weren't going to strike. They thought that they had it solved. And then a splinter group sort of met that night and somehow got the majority of workers to agree to a strike, even though they didn't really want to strike. Eventually, the commission that Governor Loudoun had working on this came to an agreement with the unions and the owners of the streetcars and L lines, and they agreed basically to raise transit fares by 40% overnight in order to get the companies enough money to pay the kind of wages that their workers were demanding. So this created enormous upset among commuters in Chicago. This was one of the reasons that Thompson was able to come out of this crisis stronger than before, even though his performance during it was horrible. You know, he was just being inactive. But he was able to take advantage of the outrage at the governor that resulted from, you know, as a result of these transit strike, these transit fares going up by 40%. And he was able to use that outrage, also the outrage of the African-American community at the investigation of the riot cases, which was a notoriously racist investigation. You know, they were just basically indicting black rioters, and no white rioters were being brought before the grand jury. So Thompson was able to use all of this outrage to build his base. And so even though his performance during the crisis was pretty dismal, he emerged at the end of 1919 more powerful than ever. And as a matter of fact, in the next elections that they had in spring of 1920, his machine was able to attain a level of command at both the state and the city level that had not that had been unprecedented in Illinois politics until this day. So, you know, even though you would think that the mayor of this city that had just been through this crisis is going to pay the price for it, he was a master politician, and he was able to turn it to his advantage and end up stronger than before.
So was it the power of Thompson, of Mayor Thompson, that came out of these events that shaped modern Chicago in the end, or was it the events themselves?
Well, I think it was both. For one thing, the riot certainly it set the tone for race relations in the city for many years to come. There was understandably a lot of bitterness after the riot, and it really hardened the color line that had been developing in the city over the previous few years. So I would say that it left a legacy of segregation in Chicago that lasted for decades, and some would say exists to this day in Chicago. Chicago remains one of the most segregated cities in the country. But interestingly, there were some black leaders at the time who found a silver lining to the riots. They claimed that the violence had actually galvanized the African-American community to finally stand up to discrimination and assert their rights as American citizens, particularly given the fact that they had performed very well in the war. So, and they also claimed that the riots raised awareness about racial injustice among a lot of sympathetic whites. So, you know, there was a silver lining to this, and some argued that there was a mixed legacy to the race riots. As far as Thompson's the legacy that he left and the fact that he was able to emerge stronger than ever, it was also a mixed legacy because on the one hand, you know, he was, as I say, this builder, and he got a lot of things built in Chicago that might not otherwise have been built. But he was also notoriously corrupt and an opponent of Prohibition, and he was notoriously friendly with Al Capone. So I think you had the city of Chicago descending into this lawlessness of the Jazz Age, largely as a result of Thompson's preeminence in the 1920s. And even today, you go to Europe and you say Chicago, and the first thing they say back to you is Al Capone. I mean, it ruined Chicago's reputation for decades.
I think I'm going to try to take one quick comment as we near the end of our show today. And I want to say hello to Lawrence in Savoy. We just have about half a minute.
Yes, I understand. 30 seconds. The odds are quite reasonable that the connection with the child killing is simply that predators wait for moments to strike, usually whether it's the black kid going to rob the black grandma down the block, whether it's the white child abuser going to try to steal a kid and have sex and kill it, or whether it's a black kid going to rape some 12-year-old girl. You get the point. Predators wait for good moments to strike.
Yeah, I think the chaotic atmosphere that was prevailing at the time was probably instrumental in both.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it right there. Gary Crist is an author of both fiction and nonfiction, and his newest work of nonfiction is City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago, published by Crown Publishers. Gary, thank you very much for being on the air with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. You can hear this program twice each weekday, live at 10 a.m. Central Time and then repeated weeknights at 8 on WYLL AM 580. If you know someone who might enjoy hearing Focus but can't tune in during the day, let them know about that evening rebroadcast. Also, if you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus who lives outside of our listening area, let them know that we stream this program live every day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back to past programs. Each day's show is usually up on the web by early afternoon. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, again, visit the Focus page of our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, Craig Cohen is back with his guest, journalist and author Lynn Povich. She worked for Newsweek magazine back in 1970, when the magazine was covering the growing women's rights movement. At the same time, the magazine was defending itself against charges of discriminating against women in hiring and promotion, charges that came from Povich and her female co-workers. She's written about it in her book, The Good Girls Revolt, and she'll talk about it tomorrow morning on Focus. Today's show was produced by Travis Danzel. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. I'm Jim Meadows.